Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. In this pre-taped show, we'll be talking with some of the experts at the wonderful, wonderful exhibit at Sotheby's. Over 400 objects that describe the history of our people, objects that are true works of art, some of them almost indescribable words, you have to come and see it. The history behind each and every one of these is absolutely fascinating, and each one of them is an excellent example of what we have gone through history, what we have to look ahead to. We will start with Sotheby's Vice President and Curator for Silver Objects, John Ward. Good evening, Mr. Ward.
Good evening.
Tell us a little bit about some of the interesting items here and possibly the history, and if you could just describe it for people so that they could see it through the radio.
Well, we're standing now in front of a wonderful tower form Sabbath lamp that was made in Frankfurt in the early 18th century. It's suspended from an eagle-headed hook, and it's in the form of a multi-tiered tower topped with a cupola. And on a balcony around that cupola are figures holding emblems of the Jewish holidays. Each of the figures is only about 2 inches tall, but going all the way around, you have all of the major holidays represented. Hanukkah, Sukkot, Yom Kippur, etc. Coming out from this are branches for the candles, and below that are three wonderfully decorated tiers of just windows and cannon mouths and monster masks. Before you get to the star form oil lamp, which would have been lit for Shabbat, but coming down from those, in order to keep drips of oil off the floor for the good German housewife, are channels going down to an oil receptacle at the bottom. The whole of the lamp is less than 2 feet tall, and it's just really a wonderful example of silver artistry on a small scale for very, very wealthy patrons from the Frankfurt ghetto about 1710 to 1720.
As a matter of fact, the detail is exquisite. It's hard to believe that there could be this much detail in such tiny little pieces. Incredible.
The lamp is an extremely rare survival. As you can imagine, items like this with this much precious metal would be targets for theft or being melted at various times. This one is in particularly good condition, a rare survival and a real triumph of the craftsman's art. It comes from a period that's described as the golden age of German jewelry, certainly of Frankfurt jewelry. And looking at this, you understand why. The culture that could both commission this and appreciate it at the dawn of the Age of Enlightenment, it says something about how established they are, how wealthy they are, how cultivated they are. At a time when many Jews weren't even allowed to live in these cities in ghettos, the inhabitants of the Frankfurt ghetto were valued by the city fathers, were protected. Jews from other communities, particularly from outlying farming communities, were trying to come in despite the fact that there were rules against how many people could be in there. At the early 18th century, the Frankfurt ghetto was probably the most densely populated place in Europe, very similar to what the Orchard Street area would be like also for Jews in the early 20th century.
Okay. Are there any other pieces you would like to discuss with us?
Coming from this, which is an example of an affluent class, living in a major city, I'd like to go look at a Lord Mayor's dish, which was presented by the London Jewish community, the Lord Mayor of London, in recognition of the privileges that they received in a similar fashion at a similar time.
Thank you. This is another extremely exquisitely detailed silver dish. Again, the type of work that I doubt anybody could produce today, certainly not at a price that most humans could afford. What can you tell us about it?
This is a silver tray that was presented by the congregation of Bevis Marks, the primary synagogue in London, to the Lord Mayor of London in 1719. Starting about 1679, every year for a century, the congregation of Bevis Marks gave a gift to the Lord Mayor. Many of them took a purse filled with silver coins. Others opted for a piece of presentation silver like this, which would have been presented to the Lord Mayor, heaped with sweetmeats. London has a new Lord Mayor every year, so this is something that the community would have to do every year. But we only know of seven trays of this type that are surviving from the first 50 years of the community giving this gift. This is a time when, although there's a prominent and flourishing Jewish community in London, they are still a little bit at the mercy of the authorities, both the Crown and the civic authorities in London. An attempt, a Jewish naturalization bill in 1750, about 30 years after this is presented, was repealed because of popular demand within about 2 years. So it gives some ideas to you, although they're very wealthy and very important economically, you know, they're not official, and it's, you know, the trays like this is such a wealthy gift being presented by the congregation. It is a recognition of the privileges that the Lord Mayor has and that he can protect them from. As in so many other places, you know, there's agitation by the local merchants against Jewish merchants for competition, just general prejudice. But the Lord Mayor of London could, you know, doubled with the crown, could provide this community with the sort of stability that in the early 18th century was rare, except in places like London and Frankfurt. As a piece of craftsmanship, it's wonderful. It's actually slightly stylistically out of date. They set the style for these trays in 1679 when they give the first one, and it's retained by the first two head rabbis of Bevis Marks. And it's not until the death of the second rabbi in about 1730 that they update the style. So for English silver collectors, you know, this piece is rather out of style for 1719. But this is something that we see a lot of in Judaic art. You know, they tend to be very conservative. You know, they're looking back, not necessarily retardataire, but just an inherent conservatism, an appreciation for tradition that's seen in this dish, even though this is a tradition of only 30 years.
How much is something like this appraised for?
We have an estimate on this of $300,000 to $500,000. You know, that's our best guess as to where it could go in auction. You know, auction estimate is usually based on the performance of similar pieces in mm-hmm. the past. This one appeared at auction, I believe, in the early 70s, and before that, one of these Lord Mayor's dishes hadn't been seen on the market since the 1920s. So I think on Monday we'll discover if we either got it right, which I hope. I'd actually love to be proved very, very wrong and have that estimate left very far behind for an object of this quality and historic importance.
And what about the land? How much does that one go for?
Oh, that's, you know, this is always a crystal ball game that I'm loath to play. The estimate on the lamp is $800,000 to $1.2 million, which is a substantial figure that not too many people can afford. You know, it all depends on what happens that day, whether it's a piece of this quality and importance, of course, has institutional interest. But sometimes it's hard for institutions to get their funds together on short notice and get through all of the committees. I think we'll be very curious to see. You know, it makes for the excitement of an auction.
You realize I was counting on having that one for the Shabbat after this one. Of course, with that price, I just have to work a few more months.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Where is it from?
Frankfurt.
From the synagogue?
No. It's a Sabbath lamp. It would have been used in a private house.
What are we looking at now?
This is a wonderful Venetian Torah crown of about 1740, of just truly stupendous scale. Most of these crowns that survived from the 18th century are sort of about 9 inches high and about a similar diameter. This one's closer to 14 inches in diameter, 12 inches high, and just a real tour de force of chasing. The form of the crown has almost disappeared into these vigorous scrolls, S scrolls and C scrolls, which are separated by almost three-dimensional vases of flowers, and all of it's pierced out with swags of fruit below. This is a silversmith who just had an incredibly sure touch and knew just how far he could push and pull and pierce his metal and still have an object where the design is very easy to read and is stable enough to have lasted almost 300 years at this point.
Looking at it, it shows power, it shows beauty, and it shows a true understanding, as you said, of the metal, how far you can push the metal. I mean, whoever did this was an incredible artist. Do we know the name of the artist?
It's an artist called Andrea Zambelli, whose mark and whose nickname was L'Onesta, which says something about the other silversmiths of the time. He had to identify himself as the honest one. He would have been a Christian artist, because in order to be a member of European guilds at this time, you did have to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. Jews were not allowed. But we do know that there are certain artists who obviously, had close ties with the Jewish community. We see it in major cities such as Frankfurt, in London, both the pieces we've looked at before. And this one, again, we know that L'Onesta made several pieces preserved in various Italian communities, including a pair of finials that are part of the group that was recently rediscovered under a staircase in the Venetian ghetto. He's being used by several communities on the peninsula. He obviously knows what the forms are. At some point, obviously, when you've got a Christian silversmith, you're going to have to either show him what you want or describe it very carefully. But this is someone who knows the form of a Torah crown, knows finials, knows what his patrons are looking for. The temple elements that are on this, the menorah, the priestly garment, the tablets of the law, are actually made by another silversmith whose mark is on there. And again, these are very accurate depictions according to the biblical description. The priestly garment hung with bells, etc. So these are people who are being guided by the patron. This is the sort of very active give and take between patron and artist, which is a hallmark of the highest end art that's being produced at this time. These are so far from off the rack. This is the sort of thing that is enormously expensive. With this sort of scale, we don't know even if it was ever actually used on a Torah, or if it would have been an ornament, for instance, for the Bima or for the Ark. By the 19th century, you get crowns on this scale, but this is the largest 18th century one I've ever seen.
Do we know whether the second silversmith was also an honest one, or...?
We actually don't even know his name. We just know him by his mark, MP, with the Lion of San Marco.
Ah.
There is an inscription on it, though, relating to Gabriel Trieste, who was a philanthropist in Padua from 1784 to 1860 and was president of the Jewish community there. This is a later inscription. It's been changed on the band. The name Trieste wasn't changed, but the lead-in name was changed, suggesting that this crown had originally been presented somewhere by an earlier member of the same family and was represented and rededicated by Gabriel Trieste in the 19th century. We know he was an active patron who gave a prize for promoting the work of young Jewish artists and also helped finance the publication of the history of the Jews in Italy at this time.
How much would something like this go for?
Oh, again, that's the toss-up. We have an estimate on this of $300,000 to $500,000. And, a price like that puts it in a group of elite collectors and institutions. And while everyone acknowledges the quality, we have to hope that someone's going to step forward and be willing to pay that amount to be able to take it home and display it either in their gallery or in their institution.
While there are some real masterpieces in this sale, there's also smaller things. You know, a great part of the sale is under $5,000. Because Mr. Steinhardt wanted objects that reflected, you know, not just the elite, but also the day-to-day lives of the objects, and also because he wants people who are buying in this sale, you know, this is one of the reasons he's selling it, so that people can take an object home and live with it and feel connected to their Jewish heritage through having these objects in their homes as they've been in homes, you know, throughout the history of their existence. An example of these smaller items, we have a German silver Kiddush cup from the mid-19th century. Fairly plain goblet form with a ribbed pedestal base, and then foliage that comes up and covers the lower part of the bowl below a Hebrew inscription. We don't know who the maker is. It's not a maker we've been able to identify, but we do know from the marks that it's before about 1870. And a piece like this is priced at $1,500 to $2,000. You know, it's an example of, you know, the items that were made for prosperous German and Eastern European Jews in the mid-19th century. You know, the urbanized, the assimilated. This may even have been a standard goblet form that was only Judaicized by its contemporary Hebrew inscription. But again, it's part of the multi-layered history of the Jewish people that Mr. Steinhardt tried to communicate and that we've also tried to put on display with this exhibition.
What I find interesting about this particular case is not just the Kiddush cup, the goblet, but also what looks like a Megillat Esther, a mezuzah case, and the ring, which I believe was used at the wedding ceremony.
It's a silver gilt and enamel wedding ring of the traditional sort of house form with the bright blue enamel roof. A very decorative piece. This one, you know, was probably only used just to be ceremoniously placed on the finger for a short time. Certainly nothing of this elaboration or weight would have actually been worn, or the enamel would not be in such good condition. Some of the other objects, like the Esther scrolls, do show signs of use and, you know, have been used and worn. These are two lovely filigree examples, Polish, mid-19th century, one with little gems and topped with an eagle that's in for about $2,000 to $3,000. The other one slightly earlier, same general form. Checking the price. In for $3,000 to $5,000 because of the earlier date. The early one actually also has a later inscription engraved in Hebrew: "A present to the groom, the young man Israel Berka, 1883," which gives a sense of, you know, not just the period when this object was made, but also, you know, how it was used and re-given and reappreciated by later generations.
Again, the filigree is exquisitely detailed. Shows it beautiful, beautiful workmanship. Again, I doubt that anybody could reproduce that today with that degree of artistry.
It's certainly not where it was done before. There's some actually Middle Eastern communities that can still do it at this level, and a couple of Russian craftsmen I know. But in the traditional communities where this was done, in Poland and Eastern Europe, these skills are pretty much gone, except for these wonderful objects that they've left behind.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ward. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to see the exhibit.
And I hope to see you again when you have the next exhibit.
All right. Or come to the auction. It should be fun.
Absolutely. Thank you. And with me now is Charmin, Senior Consultant in Judaica, to Sotheby's. Good evening, Charmin.
Pleasure to be speaking to you about this wonderful collection. We are standing in front of and looking at a power binder known as a zimpel. It's part of the Ashkenazic tradition, where the tradition was that the swaddling cloth that was used at the circumcision was cut into four pieces and then embroidered, generally by men of the community, not by women, or painted by men of the community, sometimes the scribe of the community. And after that, they were sewn together in four pieces and then presented to the synagogue at the time of the child's first arrival in the synagogue. And the time of this varies from community to community. I've seen sometimes where it was in the child's first birthday. Other communities reported as the third or the fifth birthday when the child first came to the synagogue. It's actually a ceremony known as Schultragen. There's a painting, very famous painting, the Schultragen, by Maurice Oppenheim. And this particular binder is embroidered in multicolored thread. It's dated 1736, and it includes a number of very interesting illustrations, including an image of a snake above, that's coming off of the lamed, which is a reference to the Fat Katan, at the end of the date. And the snake is seen actually in many Ashkenazic binders, and this is a tradition which began, well, the Ashkenazic binder tradition begins in the 16th century apparently. The ones that we have here are from the 17th century onwards. And we believe that the snake is actually an interesting allusion to the demon Samael. Samael appears to Eve as a snake when he tempts her with the apple, and then Sefer Sod Hashem, which is a book relating to the laws of Brit Milah, mentions that Samael is banished at the moment of the Brit, when the child is brought in to the members of the Jewish community. And we believe that this image of a snake might have amuletic portent.
And indeed, if we look at the top of the lamed, that snake seems to be running away.
Yeah, that's true. It does look like it's running away, like it's fleeing. And many of the snakes actually are there. In fact, in one of the Alsatian binders, a snake is crowned. And we do know that, of course, when Samael appears to Eve, he was the king of beasts, and he was crowned. I think that's another reason to lead us to believe that this should be the case. We also have the Tainted Torah binder from Halberstadt, which shows you the tradition where there's more imagery, including a chuppah scene, because these Torah binders all had a very standard, the ones from Ashkenaz, a very standard inscription. It tells us about the child. It gives us his name, his date of birth. Sometimes we include an image of the zodiac sign for the month in which he was born. And then we offer the wish, may God grant that he grow to Torah, to chuppah, and to ma'asim Torah. That he grow to learn Torah, to study Torah, to a marriage, and to good deeds. And often we have images of the Torah scroll and the chuppah scene. And you'll especially see that in the Copenhagen binders. They're highly articulated. And in the Halberstadt binder from 1756. We're looking here at a group of four Alsatian Torah binders. One is a lot by itself, 255, which includes remarkable imagery of French colors and men in military costumes holding flags aloft, and actually with horns blowing and guns firing. And the imagery is quite intriguing because we see that the Jews are incorporating imagery that was consistent with the culture in which they lived. The scribe is kind of taking note of various things. So for example, where we have the name of the child as Wolf is the last name, Meir, and in French it's Emile, the son of Philidor Wolf, right? There are two wolves on either side of the child's name, indicating it. And in addition, we have the traditional imagery that one would find of a Torah, an open Torah scroll, and a chuppah, a marriage canopy. And the marriage canopy includes the words, initials for the word Siman Tov, and Kol Sasan, Kol Simcha, Kol Chatan, and Kol Chala. That we see on the other painted Alsatian Torah binder, Vimpel as well. Vimpel is from the word bevinden, an old Germanic word meaning to wind. And these are wound around the Torah scroll, and that is presumably where the word comes from, and is derived from.
Do we see a similar tradition of winding things around the Torah scroll other than in Ashkenaz?
No, yes. In Italy, we also have the same tradition of Torah binders, but those are created by the women of the community. Mm-hmm. And are
they stylistically similar?
Not at all. No, there's a completely different stylistic element. Number one, Torah binders from Germany always include a very specific text where they say the name of the child and the father's name, the date that the child was born, and the wish that he grow up to Torah, to Supao, to Masim Tovim. But in Italy, they don't include that at all. Rather, there's generally a dedicatory inscription by the woman who created it, where she wishes that God should watch out for her and her family. And we have one where she offers the wish that she may she merit male children, Banim Sarim, yes. And it's often dedicated to the husbands and the fathers of the woman who gave it to the synagogue.
Okay, thank you very much, Mrs. Mintz.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure.
And with me now is Jennifer Roth, who is in charge of all the Judaica exhibits at Sotheby's. I believe you're a vice president of Sotheby's.
I'm a senior vice president, and I run the Judaica and Israeli art sales, yes.
Okay. What are some of the past Judaica exhibits you've had here?
Sotheby's has had Judaica sales for decades, actually, going way back to the 1940s. But some of the major sales include the Montefiore collection of Hebrew books and manuscripts, the Zagaisky silver sales over many years. We've sold many wonderful pieces from the Sassoon family, and more recently the Delmonico collection.
And of course, you still have the Val Madonna collection.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We're looking for a good home.
Tell us a little bit about this particular exhibit today, about the Steinhardt collection, and how you choose the pieces that you would auction.
Well, the Steinhardt collection is the most important collection of Judaica to come to auction in at least 50 years. It includes silver, textiles, manuscripts. The highlight, of course, is the Mishneh Torah from 1457, Northern Italy, and that's the most expensive item at 4.6 to 6 million. And then we have items that are much more modest in price. In fact, hundreds of items under $5,000, going all the way down to $200 to $300 for a decorated shofar and for a matzah tool. So you have the full sweep of Jewish history and the full sweep of Jewish objects, from very inexpensive all the way up to the most expensive.
And how do you come to choose the particular objects that you have on exhibit, or is this the complete collection?
This is the majority of Mr. Steinhardt's Judaica collection. He did, of course, keep a certain number of pieces for himself, for his family, but most of his collection is here for sale. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mrs. Roth. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And with me now is David Bartel, special consultant to Sotheby's on all subjects Judaica. Good evening, Mr. Bartel.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about the Mishneh Torah. Let's describe it so that people, even though they are listening to radio, can somehow visualize it.
The Mishneh Torah is, as we know, the first code of Jewish law after the Talmud. It is organized by subject matter. The Rambam put it into this order to make it easy for people to use, to find halachot, and to discover what they wanted to find. Written in the 12th century, in the latter part of the 12th century, the Mishneh Torah became very, very widespread very quickly, and many, many copies of the Mishneh Torah were made. For certain very, very wealthy families, they would commission someone to write a beautifully decorated copy. An expert sofer would come and write, and they would hire artists to come and illustrate and illuminate the pages. There are four existing decorated Mishneh Torahs from the Renaissance period or before, and within 300 years of the Rambam's life. This particular copy of the Mishneh Torah was written in 1457 by an expert sofer named Nehemia, somewhere in northern Italy. Obviously, all 14 books in the Mishneh Torah were completed. Because of the size of the volume, at close to 1,000 pages, it was divided into two different krachim, two different volumes. And we have one of these volumes here. It contains the last eight Sfarim of the Yad HaChazaka, of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, and the other, the first five volumes are the first five books of the Mishneh, of this particular copy of the Mishneh Torah are in the Vatican Library in Rome. The, there's one section of the Mishneh Torah that's missing, but it's missing from the Vatican copy. This was, in addition to the expertly and beautifully handwritten Hebrew text in both brown and red ink, the every page of every one of the 14 books has a beautiful, nearly full page illumination that very, very elaborately discusses details of some halacha in the Rambam. So by Sefer Nezikin, the book of damages, we show an image of two young men involved in a fight and grabbing each other and attacking each other to discuss. Obviously, this is a reference to the laws of wounding and the maybe even if that guy sticks his knife in the other guy, it'll be the laws of murder.
Right.
There's a scene where a burglar is breaking into a house and taking clothes. Then on top, you see there's a scene of a Shor Shenagach, an ox that is gored
right.
Somebody. There's another place where a chamor fell into a boar. The question is the owner of the boar responsible? Yes. In this case, the owner of the shore is responsible. I mean, so that, but each of these, even though the pictures are done by a Christian illuminator, he's known as the master of the Barbo Missal, which is he's named after another famous book that he did. He also, we know that he worked on the most famous Renaissance manuscript ever, was the Bible of Borso de Este, and he did some of the illuminations for that. So this is a very, very accomplished illuminator. If you look at Sefer Tara, right, there's a wonderful illustration of a mace under an ohel. So we know that all that tumas ohel. And there's two people standing in the field discussing. But people say, well, everybody knows that. But if you look closely at the picture, in the picture there are different trees. And one of the trees is a fruit tree. And if you look carefully in the Rambam, you'll find the Rambam passes, you cannot ever plant a fruit tree in a cemetery because the roots grow up close to the ground and could be touching
right,
the maze. So that somebody walks by under the fruit tree, they're now also in tumas soil. So this is the kind of thing that a Christian illuminator would never have known on his own, but clearly, very clearly, and very, very specific instructions. And the same is true for many other illustrations. There are dozens and dozens of pages with beautiful illuminated words set on a beautiful blue background. It's really, it's a manuscript like no other. Right? There are very few high-quality Hebrew manuscripts from the Renaissance period which are left. This is the first one of its quality to come onto the public market in many, many years, and unlikely that there will be anything of this quality on the market anytime soon again. It's a very, very special opportunity, and if your listeners have an opportunity to come see it, it'll be on display until Sunday.
And I understand that the Mishneh Torah that you have here is only the second volume out of the two volumes.
Well, it's the second volume. It has eight of the 14 Sfarim. So it starts, I think, in Zeraim and goes all the way to Shoft.
And where do we believe the first volume is?
The first volume is in the Vatican Library. It's in the Vatican Library in Rome. So we don't have to, I mean, we know it's there.
I see.
But I will tell you this, it was always designed as two volumes, the same sofer, but different illuminators. Very, very clearly, you can compare the images. The illuminator of this volume was much more accomplished in the way he applied the gold, much more accomplished in the pictures and the designs. So we're very fortunate to have, of the two halves, we have the better half.
Are there many titles that Jewish titles that were illuminated?
We have most of the illuminated manuscripts that we have from the Middle Ages, from the Renaissance. We have usually, typically, are either Sidurim, Machzorim. We have some Haggadot. It's very rare that we have Sifrei Halacha that are illuminated, although there's a very famous Arba Turim. But these are individual. I mean, there is one arbiter that is illuminated and gorgeous. But there are four decorated Mishneh Torahs. This is the most elaborately decorated. But as a rule, Sifrei Halacha, law codes, were not illuminated. Only for the wealthiest patron, only for the wealthiest Jewish family.
Nobody had that authority.
Right. Makzorim, a few more, Haggadahs, a few more, but on the whole, we have many sparrows from that time, but not that many, you know, beautifully decorated ones.
Okay, and one last question. We mentioned the Vatican. Do we really know, do we have a catalog of all the Judaica stuff that they have, or not really?
Well, thanks to the work of Binyamin Richler and Malachi Beit Aryeh, we do now have a catalog of all of the books, all the Hebrew books that the Vatican Library has, we do have. And I think that we know also the Judaica they have. Many people often ask me, you know, about the famous image in the Arch of Titus of the Roman soldiers coming back from Churban Yerushalayim carrying the menorah. And while that is certainly a historical truism, the menorah, which was probably in the Roman treasury, but didn't survive the sack of Rome in 410, and certainly never belonged to the Vatican. It belonged to, you know, belonged to Rome. I mean, belonged to Rome, belonged to us. But it belonged. It was captured by the Romans. But it was absolutely, almost. There is no doubt that when the Gothic invasions, you know, sacked Rome in 410, that it was among the spoils of war. That it was taken, almost certainly melted down. And when Mashiach comes, we have to make it all.
And is it true that they have the vestments of the Kohen Gadol, or is that just a rumor?
I don't believe it. I have to tell you that vestments from anything that is 2,000 years old in clothing wouldn't have survived until now anyway. And I don't, again, anything that was valuable, anything with silk or gold or, you know, none of that would have survived. It's a rumor that we've often heard, but, you know, in recent decades, not like old times, but in recent decades, the Vatican has opened itself up much more to scholars in general, and particularly to Jewish scholars. So all of the Hebrew books of the Vatican, look, they're not giving them back, but at least we know what's there.
Right.
And the truth is that scholars who, you can get in to see, if there's sperm in there in the library that are important for scholars to see, they get to see them.
Do they get to copy them as well?
Yeah, they get to order photographs. I mean, like any other library. I mean, the same kinds of rules apply. But I mean, it would be nice if we had them back under our Ravanus, if you
right.
will. But the next best thing is having them available to us. That's true of many libraries. I mean, libraries around the world, different, you know, non-religious libraries, secular libraries, national libraries that have, you know, great, wonderful Hebrew works. Some of them we have. There's a strong effort in Yerushalayim to try to collect a microfilm or digital versions of every Hebrew manuscript that's out there. And the Machon LeTatzfumei Ketuvei Yad, the Institute for Microfilm Hebrew Manuscripts, has done a wonderful, wonderful job. And, you know, you're never at 100%, but they're constantly working on. So I have nothing but good things to say for the National Library of Israel and the kinds of projects that are trying to make this material available to Jews all over the world.
Thank you very much for a fascinating explanation.
Thank you.
It is fitting that we speak tonight about Sotheby's current exhibit, not only because of the proximity to the auction, which will take place this coming Monday, but also because tonight is Lag BaOmer. What is the connection, you may ask, between Lag BaOmer and this particular exhibit? Let me start by relating a little story. When Shimon Bar Yochai, whose yahrzeit, whose Hilula is today, when he came out of the cave where he had been hiding from the Romans, he took a look at the world around them, and while he and his son were secreted away in the cave with no companionship other than themselves, and busy studying and composing the Zohar HaKadosh, he could not understand how it's possible that people in the world could still commit sins.
the Almighty felt that he was not ready to come out, and he sent him down again for a year. When he came out, he saw an old man on an Erev Shabbat running with a branch, with a very aromatic branch. He stopped him and asked him, "Where are you running? You're an old man. Why are you running?" And he says, "I am running home to bring this aromatic branch to my wife. Today, tonight will be Friday night." Reb Shimon Bar Yochai was impressed and understood that people still kept the traditions, still were proud of their heritage, even if they were flawed. As you look through this wonderful exhibit, yes, you might wonder if some of the beautiful pieces that were commissioned by some very, very rich families were commissioned strictly and only for religious purposes, or were they commissioned because it would show off their work, while at the same time showing off their pride in their Jewishness. Be that as it may, just as Shimon Bar Yochai saw that his fellow Jews were continuing in their traditions, were proud of who they were, this exhibit, with a span of 1,500 years of ceremonial art, shows exactly that. We still continue our traditions, we're still proud of our ancestry, we're still proud of who and what we are. Thank you very much for listening, and tune us in again this coming Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, when our guest will be Israel Shutrit, a young Israeli who will tell us about the remarkable life journey of an Israeli in the United States. Thank you very much, and good night, one and all.